Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, we've got a number of musical surprises, like how a British guitarist ended up playing accordion for an Irish punk band, namely The Pogues. James Fearnley joins us with some of his memories from his decades with that famously wild band. Turns out it helps to keep a journal. Plus, it takes some serious chops to be able to step out from behind a musical personality as large as that of CeeLo Green. But that's exactly what the soul singer Curtis Harding recently did. He'll perform songs off his solo debut, Soul Power, live in the studio. But first, every now and then on the show, we do a series called A Year to Remember. This one takes us back to the year of America's bicentennial. Early 1976, Gerald Ford was bumbling his way through the presidency. Laverne and Shirley and the $6 million man ruled the small screen, and Frampton Comes Alive was the biggest thing in rock. All of that was about to change, and the country would never be the same. Here to tell us why is David Brown, contributing editor at Rolling Stone. His Amazon Kindle single is called The Spirit of 76, From Politics to Technology, The Year America Went Rock and Roll. David, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Glad to be here, John.
So we're talking about 1976. It was, of course, the bicentennial.
Absolutely.
You know, we had the tall ships in New York City Harbor and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Despite which, it was not a particularly optimistic time in this country.
It wasn't. We were still kind of coming out of a recession. Unemployment was a little bit higher than most people wanted. Gerald Ford wasn't, as you mentioned, the most inspiring president, perhaps. But I think there was something brewing in that year. And, you know, it first kind of occurred to me when Steve Jobs died, and I was reading all those tributes and obits, as we all did, and I was reminded that Apple launched in 1976.
Yeah, that's really, to think of that happening that far back is pretty amazing.
It was amazing. And I immediately, just seeing the number, I guess, 1976, immediately triggered all these memories in my brain. Oh, right, that was the year Jimmy Carter got elected president. That was the year the first Ramones album. I had a vague memory of Saturday Night Live really kind of coming alive right at that moment.
Well, you begin your Amazon Kindle single talking about Saturday Night Live,
right,
and the huge surprise when they walked off with all these awards.
Yeah, at the Emmy Awards in that spring, they walked off with four of them, including some of the major categories, variety show and all that. And it was a very symbolic win because they won over things like the Carol Burnett Show, which represented the kind of the mainstream,
yep,
establishment, kind of Squaresville TV of the time. And so for Saturday Night Live, which was steeped in rock and roll and drug jokes and all this stuff, to kind of come somewhat out of nowhere and take the top prize was, I think, in a way, the beginning of a really interesting year in which you saw rock and roll culture become the culture. And I think that's the thing that ties all of this together.
And as David Brown writes in his piece, The Spirit of 76, comedy was now officially the new rock.
Repeat after me. I would like
to feed your fingertips.
To feed your fingertips.
To the Wolverines.
To the Wolverines.
Next. I am afraid. We are out.
We are out.
Badgers.
Would you accept a
Wolverine?
A Wolverine.
In its place.
In its place.
Next. Haynet exclaimed.
Haynet exclaimed.
Let's boil. The Wolverine.
The Wolverines.
It makes no sense even now to a bunch of like stone teenagers watching Saturday,
right,
Night Live in 1976. Heads
were exploding.
It really was. It was that whole, if you grew up in that period, you were probably reading like National Lampoon and listening to Cheech and Chong records or whatever, you know. And it was that sort of hip counterculture humor on TV, you know, which we hadn't really seen before. We take that for granted now, like that sort of sensibility is in the air so much. But back then, it was really a shocking thing.
That was the first ever sketch from Saturday
That's
Night
right.
Live.
That's right.
Featuring writer Michael O'Donohue and the late John Belushi as language instructor and student, respectively. But already at that point, it was becoming a kind of, you know, one of those gatekeepers for the culture, because that's
right.
where you found music
right.
that you weren't hearing on mainstream radio.
Totally. I mean, it was even shocking to me, or surprising at least in my research, to look back at that first season, 75 into 76 and then into the fall of 76, and see the lineup of guests, you know, Patti Smith, Gil Scott-Heron, you know, Loudon Wainwright, Randy Newman. These were not people, you know, you saw on TV, ever.
Yeah.
You know?
My first exposure to Gil Scott-Heron was that Saturday Night Live wow. performance of Johannesburg. And it was just like, what is this?
I know.
What planet did this guy drop in from? But you mentioned Patti Smith. And, you know, she was certainly not unknown in the lower Manhattan, you know, CBGBs and places like that.
Right.
But this was like big exposure for her.
It was. To be the musical guest, and she was the guest on a show of it was called, as you say, NBC's Saturday Night, hosted by Ron Nessen, who was Gerald Ford's press secretary. That alone in that spring was mind-boggling that, you know, here's a show that repeatedly mocked Ford, and yet his press secretary was the host. That was an acknowledgement in a way, like this was the buzz show at the time.
Right. And this was one of the buzz records of that year, 1976, from Patti Smith.
He's at the stadium. Ooh, 20,000 girls calling the name out to me. Marie, Ruth, but I tell you that truth.
Gloria.
And that was the actual song she performed on Saturday Night Live that night. Kind of amazing.
David Brown's with us on Soundcheck, contributing editor at Rolling Stone and Men's Journal, and author of Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNNY, and The Lost Story of 1970. Now he's writing about 1976. His Amazon Kindle single is called The Spirit of 76, From Politics to Technology, The Year America Went Rock and Roll. In fact, you can easily draw a line, and you do, David, from the comedy of Saturday Night Live to the alternative, the emerging rock movement in Lower Manhattan.
Right. I mean, there was a physical link in that some of the Saturday Night Live people like Belushi would go down to CBGB's. And, yeah, it was also the year when sort of rock and roll became more rock and roll. You know, Peter Frampton was the big mainstream breakout star of the year, but it was really what was happening downtown, Patti, and then the Ramones album that came out that spring, that really, you know, took it back again to kind of its roots and its early days. It kind of blew away all of that, you know, post-60s singer-songwriter prog rock stuff, which was great for a while there, but sort of outstayed its welcome, both those genres. And we needed something new, and here it came.
Beat on the brat with a baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Beat on the brat with a baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh ho. Oh yeah.
bit of the Ramones' Beat on the Brat from 1976. That, too, was part of the spirit of 76 in America, a time that David Brown has written about in his piece, The Spirit of 76, From Politics to Technology, the year America went rock and roll, and we went rock and roll all the way to the White House. How was Jimmy Carter the first rock and roll president?
You know, we're living in a time now where we know what's on President Obama's iPod.
Right.
You know, look, there's Jay-Z songs and whatever. But we're talking about a time in 1976 when Carter was a largely unknown Southern governor. But in his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention, he quoted Dylan lyrics from It's All Right, Ma. He was known for hanging out with the Allman Brothers. They did benefits for him. He would name drop rock songs in interviews. And, you know, again, these days, not that unusual. Mm-hmm. Back then, he seemed like the hippest, coolest rock and roll guy.
Because we still had Watergate in our rearview mirror. And here's this guy, you know, who's traveling in very different circles.
Yeah, he's campaigning. He's wearing blue jeans. His hair was a little longer. He had that sort of the wet head is dead, you know, shag that was in all those commercials. He looked like a very different kind of politician, which is one of the reasons he just eked by and won. He promised to have more integrity and so mm-hmm. forth and blow away the Nixon years and so forth. And again, yeah, he grew up in that rock and roll culture. In fact, even in 74, 2 years earlier, when Dylan and the band did their big tour, Carter had them over to his mansion, you know,
The
governor's mansion, yeah. And of course, that probably made some people suspicious of Carter when he was hanging out with Greg Allman, but, you know, it did.
Well, it didn't hurt him that much.
Didn't hurt him.
Jimmy Carter, as David Brown just told us, quotes Bob Dylan in 1976 in his Democratic presidential nomination acceptance speech.
My vision of this nation and its future has been deepened and matured during the 19 months that I've campaigned among you for president. I've never had more faith in America than I do today. We have an America that, in Bob Dylan's phrase, is busy being born, not busy dying.
Pointed threats they bluff with scorn. Suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece. The hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying.
Now, over the years, that particular quote from Bob Dylan, you know, if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying, that's become pretty popular. But in 1976, for, you know, a presidential candidate to be quoting that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and a nighttime, you know, network televised acceptance speech.
Yeah. So let's talk Rocky.
Okay.
Not the musical, but the original film, because that, too, was part of the can-do spirit of 76.
Oh, I think, yeah, absolutely. It came out at the very end of the year, and I think it absolutely embodied that that sort of revived spirit. It was a total underdog story. And, you know, it's fascinating to watch it now, as I did again, and just see what a sort of – it seems like an indie movie now, you know.
It sort of was.
You know, they had to finance it themselves, and producers were only interested in – studios were only interested in if somebody else other than Stallone starred in it. And he stuck to his guns and said, no, I want to do it. So they had to raise the money themselves and so forth. And you know, he seems in retrospect too like very much of that moment. I thought – I couldn't help but thinking of Springsteen and Born to Run around that time, that
sure.
same kind of working class blue collar guy working hard and getting rewarded and embodying that sort of revived American spirit.
And, you know, the theme song, I mean, we should say Eye of the Tiger associated with Rocky would come later.
Right, right.
The original movie had that Bill Condon.
Let's go old school.
Yeah. With the orchestra and everything and maybe a little hint of disco,
absolutely.
Which was also in the air as well. The song, of course, is Gonna Fly Now.
Flying high,
it's cheese-tastic goodness. It's the theme from Rocky.
If all of you could just have seen John smiling when that that choir came in.
Oh, my God. Well, you know what? It was a very calculated kind of uplifting musical moment at a time that the country was ready for such a thing.
Totally ready for it. I often wonder, I asked a few people in my research, would this movie have been as big if it had come out a couple of years ago? Because the movies of the early 70s were... They were sort of dark, you know, with
Shaft.
Conversation and Shaft and all the President's Men,
which was
early 70s. French Connection. Yeah. I mean, they were very kind of cynical views of the world. And Rocky, I think, was the start of a whole wave of, you know, you could trace all kinds of Star Wars or whatever to that Saturday Night Fever and so forth.
But, yeah. We're speaking with David Brown, contributing editor at Rolling Stone and Men's Journal. He's written about the music of 1970 in the past, and now he's written about the spirit of 76, when America went rock and roll. You mentioned before, incredible as it may seem, that Steve Jobs, the first Apple computer, is 1976.
Right.
In your article, you pair that with one of the big hit records of 1976.
Absolutely, which was More Than a Feeling by Boston.
Why are those two peas in a pod?
I think one of the themes in 76, and I think you see it in like the Ramones, and you certainly see it with these tech guys, it was kind of like the revenge of the geek.
Mm-hmm.
You maybe even saw that a little bit with Saturday Night Live, you know, with some of those cast members too. And I think it was in technology, you know, you saw these guys, kind of gadget electronics freaks, basically leading the way into the future. And More Than a Feeling was basically, in many ways, a one-man band, and that man being Tom Scholz, the guitarist, songwriter, producer, the auteur of the whole band. And his day job was a Polaroid researcher, and he was a gadgets freak. He even helped build his own home studio and so forth. That was again a new type of guy in rock and roll. It was a merging of the technology and gadgets and electronics with music, which was an interesting new twist.
I looked out this morning and the sun was gone. Turned on some music to start my day. Lost myself.
Than a Feeling from 1976, the self-titled debut album by Boston. And, you know, we are still feeling the effects of that record. You know, Kurt Cobain famously ascribed that song to the, you know, as the basis for Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit.
That's true.
You know, just changed one chord and sort of created his own new song.
That's true.
That song is still on classic rock radio. It's used in TV commercials. What else, David?
You know, so much of that year, even though, you know, in a way, there was a certain sense of lost promise about that year. But if you look at the big picture, the impact, you know, the things that have stayed with us in that year, you know, really outweigh all the unfulfilled promise of that year.
The year was 1976, and David Brown writes about it in The Spirit of 76, From Politics to Technology, The Year America Went Rock and Roll. It is available now as an Amazon Kindle single. David, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Next, the Atlanta-based singer Curtis Harding brings his scorching brand of soul power to our studio. That's the name of his debut album. And later, a founding member of the thundering Celtic punk group The Pogues tells us about his many years with that band. This is Soundcheck.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. For music fans, the name Curtis will undoubtedly bring to mind Curtis Mayfield, the soul, funk, and R&B legend behind the soundtrack album Superfly and so much more. But today, we'd like to introduce you to another Curtis who's got a penchant for soul, Curtis Harding. His debut solo effort called Soul Power recently caught our ear, and today, the Atlanta-based musician and his band are here to play for us live in the studio. This song is called Next Time. Here's Curtis Harding and his band live on Soundcheck. Thank you.
That is Curtis Harding and his band live on Soundcheck. The song's called Next Time, and you'll find it on Curtis Harding's debut solo effort called Soul Power, which is out now. Curtis Harding singing and playing guitar, Randy Michael playing guitar, Curtis Whitehead playing the bass, Jonas Willey behind our drum kit, Chris Case playing the keyboards. Curtis, to you and the band, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the album's called Soul Power, and you describe your sound as sloppin' soul.
Yeah, man.
What is that?
It's the way I describe my sound, man. Because I say sloppin' soul just because sometimes it's messy, and I tend to use, like, things that I figure are left over that most artists, I guess, wouldn't incorporate in their music. You know what I'm saying? So, and you know, you feed slop to the pigs, of course. I'm not calling my music, you know, slop, but it's just the sound, man. It could be funky. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
sometimes
right.
Slop smells, so it seemed like it was appropriate.
You know, listening to this record, you hear the kind of the soul, the funk, the R&B, and then at one point, I had to turn to the CD player to make sure that I hadn't actually gone to someone else's CD.
Because, oh, man.
You know, yeah. I Don't Want to Go Home is like this little two-minute blast of post-punk.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got another out-and-out rocker with the track Surf.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, those two tracks I actually did with two Black Lips members, which is probably why the vibe is, you know.
Yeah.
I wrote I Don't Want to Go Home with Jarrett Swilley, which is actually on their record as well. He's somewhere in New York with us. He wrote down.
Now, Cole Alexander from the Black Lips,
yeah,
you
yeah.
and he are in another band together.
Yeah, we
right?
have a side project called Night Sun. So it's me, Cole, we started the band, Cole Alexander, Danny Lee from this band called the Night Beats, and Joe Bradley, actually, from Black Lips. He plays drums for us, so, yeah.
Okay. So all of the things that you've done in your career, singing with CeeLo Green, growing up in a family with gospel music in the back, so all of that is part of the slop in the...
It's all, yeah, exactly. Exactly, man. Yep.
All right. Curtis Harding is with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Soul Power is the name of the record. And I've read in a couple of different interviews, you know, although you share a first name with Curtis Mayfield, it seems like your musical role model is someone far more obscure. Tell us who Willie Hutch is.
Willie Hutch is a guy who was signed to Motown. He was a producer, songwriter.
Was he a bass player?
He played all sorts of instruments. Yeah. He played bass, he played guitar. Great singer.
Mm.
He could actually even rap, too. Like, yeah, it's crazy. Like, he actually, he was on this...
Now, what about you? Do you rap? I mean, you're from Atlanta.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
I might do it tonight. We're just working out. we're actually working out like a cover for tonight. So if whoever comes out the Glasslands, they might get a treat.
Okay.
So, yeah. But, sometimes we dabble. In the van, we'll ride around and we'll have like a little session or something.
Okay. Anyway, I interrupted you. You're talking about Willie Hutch.
Yeah, Willie Hutch, man. He was the man. Like, he's one of my idols.
Let's give listeners a chance to hear a little bit of Willie Hutch's music. This is a track called Love Power.
Talking about love power. Talking about love power.
Come on, put your hands together.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Oh.
So that's a little bit of Willie Hutch, who, as Curtis Harding was just telling us, was signed to Motown, a producer, multi-instrumentalist, songwriter. So that song's called Love Power. Curtis, your record is called Soul Power. And this Willie Hutch piece, you know, that has the sound
of, man.
You know, mid-70s analog recording.
Yeah.
Now, you produced your own record, Soul Power. Were you going for that kind of vintage sound as well?
I wasn't necessarily going for any sort of sound. That's just what happened. You know what I mean? Like, I knew I wanted to record it analog just because it sounds great. Like, you know, it sounds better. You know what I mean? But I wasn't going for any sort of sound. I was just writing songs that I like, you know what I'm saying? The style is the style that I enjoy, you know,
right.
The style of music I enjoy.
So. Although as a producer, one of the first decisions you have to make is, am I going to record this in an all-digital studio?
Exactly.
Am I going to go to a place that has analog tape?
And exactly, exactly.
So you opted for the reel-to-reel tape.
I opted for the reel-to-reel tape, man. And I sure did.
And happy with the results?
I am.
Yeah.
I am, man. I had a good team. I had a good group of people, man, working with me, so.
Now, I mentioned before you grew up in a family of gospel singers.
Mm-hmm. My mom's a gospel singer, and she still sings gospel. She's on the road now, actually.
So how old were you when you started performing music that was not gospel, that was not sanctified sounds?
I think I was maybe 17, 18.
Yeah.
Once I started, you know, rebelling
against
everything that my mother thought was, you know, far away.
And for mom, was it just like, you know, that's the devil's music or it's still music?
At first, yeah, she was really strict about that. She didn't want us to listen to anything. They call it secular. She said, you don't listen to that in my house. But somehow we seemed to find it anyways, you know. So, but yeah, she was really strict.
And when you started listening, was it rock? Was it rap? Was it funk? What were you listening to?
It was all of that. The first record I actually, not record, it was a tape.
Uh-huh.
The first tape I got a hold of that I was able to like actually get myself was a Too Short tape. So yeah, man,
not suitable for dinner time.
No, not suitable for dinner time at all, man. No, so yeah, man.
Well, the album Soul Power, as you mentioned before, sort of a summation of all these things that you've heard, that you've done, that you've played, and most of the songs written by you, although Randy helped on a
Keep On Shining. Yep. Randy co-wrote that with me. Randy Michael's a guitar player.
Okay.
For the night.
All right. You want to play it for us?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Curtis Harding and his band live on Soundcheck. The song appears on Curtis's debut solo effort called Soul Power, which is out now. They're playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio, and we're going to hear another song, one that Curtis mentioned just a moment ago, co-written with guitarist Randy Michael. It's called Keep On Shining. It's Curtis Harding and the band live on Soundcheck.
Oh,
Curtis Harding with Keep On Shining. You'll find that on his album Soul Power, but that's a live performance by Curtis and the band here in the Soundcheck studio. Once again, Curtis Harding singing, bit of tambourine on that song, Randy Michael playing guitar, Curtis Whitehead on bass, Jonas Swilly behind the drum kit, Chris Case playing the keys. Curtis, it's been a lot of fun meeting you and having the band
Likewise,
here.
Man. Thanks for having us, man.
Next, James Fearnley tells us about his decades-old relationship with one of the most entertaining and unpredictable frontmen in music, Shane McGowan of the Pogues. Fearnley has written a memoir of his time with Shane and the band, and he'll share stories from it next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Fans of Celtic music and fans of punk didn't really have too much in common until the Pogues came along. A punk band with mandolins and accordion and a singer who straddled both worlds, the magnetic, if often troubled, Shane McGowan. An account of the Pogues' wobbly rise to pop stardom and a few blurry tours thrown in as well is told in a recent memoir by James Fearnley. He plays accordion for the Pogues, and his book is called Here Comes Everybody, The Story of the Pogues. He joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. James, welcome.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
So the book actually opens with you and most of the rest of the Pogues kicking Shane out of the band. You're in Japan, 1991. And Shane's response is, you've been very patient with me. What took you so long?
Well, it's that question that sort of kicks off the whole book. And I suppose in some sense, it's the book is my attempt to answer the question, what took us so long?
You first meet Shane McGowan when he's going under the name Shane O'Hooligan.
Yeah.
So you had a warning sign right away of what you were getting into.
I suppose I did. I mean, I'd seen his name in the press quite a bit in the Melody Maker and the NME, and you're like kind of curious as to somebody who could have a name like that. When I turned up for the audition for his band, the Nips,
yeah,
back in 1980, I was the fifth guitarist that they had, and there was the tenth drummer in the room, and it took me a little while to twig who he was. A guy so full of charisma from the set off, really slouching, unattachable. I was just lucky to be able to play the right stuff.
And the audition revolves around you going from the studio to the pub, back to the studio, back to the pub to finally get the work. So, you know, pubs have an important role to play in the story of the Pogues
and in English culture generally.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
His first question to you is something along the lines of, can you play Disconnected Shards of Industrial Noise?
That's right. So and those were his exact words. I'm not making it up. And I'd been going to auditions around London for quite a bit and playing all sorts of stuff, like from Soul here. But you just do anything that they ask you to do as best as you can.
So if Shane had had, say, Throbbing Gristle in mind when he asked you that question,
yeah,
it must have been a surprise when you finally got the gig and ended up playing music like, say, Boys from County Hell, which is not disconnected shards of industrial noise.
No, it's not. There was a year and a half gap between the end of the Nips where I rededicated myself to writing, and I wanted to write a novel, and I set myself up in my flat in Mornington Crescent, and I had a sign on the wall next to my bed which just had the words "Get Up" on it. So that's what I did every day and wrote. And then a year and a half later, after I'd sold my guitar and my amp, that Jem Finer, the Pogues banjo player, came to visit me, and he had an accordion that he'd borrowed from somebody in a laundry bag. And he said the way that he found me was he knew the building where I was, and he went to each floor listening for the typewriter and then homed in on the flat that I was living in from the typewriter noise.
And his idea was, well, you had piano lessons as a kid. Surely you must be able to play the accordion. Let's hear my guest, James Fearnley, playing the accordion with the band The Pogues from their 1984 record called Red Roses for Me. The song is Boys from County Hell.
But sit and watch the junkies and drunks up in stores. Buy green bottles sitting on the floor. I wish to Christ that I had 50 more. And it's lend me £10. Oh boy, you a drink. And mother wake me early in the morning. And it's lend me £10. Oh boy, you a drink. And mother wake me early in the morning. The boys and me are drunk and looking for you. We'll eat your friggin' entrails and we won't give a damn. Me daddy was a bloodshed and my mother a madame. My brother earned his medals and my lay in Vietnam. And it's lent me £10 for five.
The Pogues from their album Red Roses for Me, 1984 recording Boys from County Hell. Shane McGowan singing, James Fearnley playing the accordion. James is the author of the book Here Comes Everybody, The Story of the Pogues. Here Comes Everybody.
Oh, I nicked it.
From
James Joyce.
From Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's like one of the sketches that formed the basis of large sections of Finnegan's Wake. I can't say that I've read all of Finnegan's Wake, but I've read bits of it, and I spent a bit of time unearthing recordings of James Joyce reading from it, which is really interesting.
He's got a very musical. I mean, he
yeah,
was...
no, so he has, yeah, because he was a tenor singer himself.
So there, I mean, Red Roses for Me is the name of a Sean O'Casey play. I mean,
and a song.
And then there's the name of the band, The Pogues, which is a shortened form of the Gaelic expression Pog Mahon.
Yes.
Kiss
that's,
my arse.
That's quite a refined pronunciation. I've not heard that kind of pronunciation before, but well done. Yeah, no, because back in the day, there was a Radio 1 disc jockey, Canadian guy called Kid Jensen, who championed us. We're forever grateful to that guy because he just took us on and played the record, the first couple of singles, quite a lot, until BBC Radio Scotland rang up to say every time you say Pog Mahon, or Pog Mahon, as you say, over the airwaves, you were basically saying kiss my ass to a lot of Gaelic speakers. So right. Kid Jensen shortened it to the Pogues.
So how much, I mean, Shane McGowan, you know, coming from this large London Irish community, you know, he had a lot of kind of pro-Republican sentiment that he would occasionally try and weave into the songs.
Yeah.
How much friction did that cause with members of the band who were trying to keep politics out of it?
Well, I think the politics, as far as we were concerned, we try to keep to an individual level rather than to go out and make a statement about what we thought of the you know, the separation of Northern and the Republic and everything. I think above all, Shane's songs are to do with individuals for the most part, except you get to a song like Birmingham Six, which took on that and made it a general statement about being Irish in the wrong place and at the wrong time.
There were six men in Birmingham and Guildford as far. They were picked up and tortured and framed by the law. And the fifth got promotion, but they're still doing time for being Irish in the wrong place and at the wrong time. In Ireland they'll put you away in the maze. In England they'll keep you for several days. God help you if ever you caught on these shores. The coppers need someone and they walk through that door. You'll be counting years for five and ten. Growing old in a lonely hell. Round the yard in a stinking cell. From wall to wall and back again. Of course I'm not judging.
Did people think you were Irish because you were up there with an accordion?
Not necessarily, because I think it was assumed that we were all Irish, and it's that assumption still persists today. And Fernley has been mistaken for an Irish
name.
It looks like an Irish name. So, but as I was telling you before, it's actually Viking.
It's a Norse name.
Yeah.
But in 1987, you guys did the Irish Rover with the Dubliners.
Yeah, no, that's like a summit meeting in a sense. Well, not maybe a summit meeting.
A meeting of two generations.
Because they were our fathers in a sense, musically speaking. It was great to work with those guys. Lovely blokes. I'm sorry that most of them are dead. It's only John Sheehan from the original Dubliners that's still alive.
On the 4th of July, 1806, we set sail from the sweet home of Cork. We were sailing away with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. It was a wonderful craft, she was rigged for the laugh. Know how the wild wind drove her. She's got several blasts. She had 27 masts, and they call her the Irish Rover.
We had 1 million bags of the best loyal rags. We had 2 million barrels of stone. We had 3 million sides of our blind horses' hides. We had 4 million barrels of bones. We had 5 million hogs, 6 million doves, 7 million barrels of porter. We had 8 million piles of old Nanny Ghost tiles and a hundred of the Irish Rover.
That is a musical meeting of the Pogues and the Dubliners. 1987, the song The Irish Rover. On Soundcheck today, we're speaking with James Fernley, the longtime accordion player for the band The Pogues, and we're talking about his book just out here in the States called Here Comes Everybody, The Story of the Pogues. Your father once said, I'm afraid your singer is a moron. If you stick with him, you're sunk.
Oh, God, no. He was so conflicted because it was something that he had wanted to do similarly. And he wanted to give me advice, the same advice that his father had given to him. But equally was proud that I'd just gone off and did it.
On the other hand, it wasn't hard to see that Shane McGowan was going to be trouble. In fact, you very early on in the book are pouring him into his flat, you know, wherever he's living,
Yeah.
So, as I said before, you had a lot of early warning signs of what was to come.
Well, so there were. But then at the same time, that when we went on tour with Elvis Costello in 1984, which was our first kind of experience of getting into the minivan and travelling, there was a lot of drink involved. But it was kind of
fraternal?
Yeah, and there was a kind of hilarity about it and a freedom, and the music went with it and the travelling. And we didn't really have very much work to do. We just had to get there and then crash through our set as best as we could in half an hour and then just go on the tear. And there was such a kind of joy about doing that maybe some of the warning signs kind of got submerged in the streams of whiskey, as it were.
Well, now the the band managed to, you know, get it together to do these tours, to do a couple of great albums. Many, many of us Pogues fans consider Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash to be a high water mark for the band.
Yeah.
And here again, we have Shane sort of referencing Irish culture, and in this case, the myth of Cuchulainn, the great Irish warrior, in a song called Sickbed of Cuchulainn.
They used in tavern, you screamed it was your shell, but I wouldn't give you service, so you kicked the windows out. They took you out into the street, kicked you in the brains, so you went back then through a bolted door and did it all again. At a sick bed of Cuchulainn, we'll kneel and say a prayer, and the ghosts are rattling at the door, and the devil's in the chair. Hey! Remember that foul evening when you heard the banshees howl? There was lazy, drunken bastards singing Billy in the Bell. They took you up to midnight mass and left you in the lurch. So you dropped a button in the plate and spewed up in the church.
A little bit of Sickbed of Cuchulainn from the Pogues album Rum, Sodomy, and the Lash from 1985. James Fearnley playing the accordion there, and he is the author of Here Comes Everybody, The Story of the Pogues, and basically giving us the story, the sort of the creation myth of
That's an interesting way of looking at it. Yeah, from the chaos and eros flying over it and, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Well, and also, you are someone who has spent time writing fiction, and you don't call this a biography, you call this a memoir. And, you know, so...
Well, it's about, well, if it's a memoir, it's about me, I suppose. I kept diaries. Well, funnily enough, I started diary writing maybe just like the year before the Pogues started up. And most of the diaries actually concerned with a relationship that I was having with a girl at the time. But the Pogues creep into it. And then when the Pogues started up, the Pogues kind of took it over. Mm-hmm. And I was like the nerd for a lot of the time in the band. I can imagine the guys coming down to the hotel room and there's, you know, James is already up and he's writing in his tiny little minuscule spidery script, you know, what they've all been saying. And I kept a notebook which I wrote down things. So that's where most of the material comes from.
And it, as we mentioned before, it ends in 1991 with the firing of Shane McGowan from the band.
Yeah.
The band reconvenes in 2001.
Yeah.
Shane sort of officially rejoins the band. Will there be a second volume? Are you still on speaking terms with all these guys after this book?
Well, I can't say that the book hasn't changed the dynamic a bit. And the reactions to the book have ranged from, I suppose, horror might be a good word, or panic, maybe, and a little bit of hatred mixed in with it, possibly. And on the other hand, I actually got proofreading help from a couple of them. It was pointed out to me that I use the word pellucid too many times. So I took a few instances of that out as well.
Okay,
but then I think things come down to settle, because there's a bond between us that is resilient to the point of never, I don't think, ever going away.
Yeah.
As
several people point out to you during the course of the book, you know, you spend more time with the band and with Shane, et cetera, than you did with your own family.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
The book is called Here Comes Everybody, The Story of the Pogues by James Fearnley, longtime accordion player for the band. James, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.
Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer, and I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.